Hello, and welcome back to the Life and Death podcast with me, Stephen Rumford, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. I've worked in palliative care for 25 years, so in this series I sit down with all different types of people to discuss their experiences of death, dying and bereavement, with the aim of finding a deeper understanding of what life and death means to them. In this episode, I'm chatting with philosopher Simon Critchley, a lecturer at the New School for Social Research in New York. Simon believes that how a person dies is as important as how they live. So he wrote a book, The Book of Dead Philosophers, where he tells the stories of how a selection of philosophers from antiquity to modern times died. I read Simon's book and was so captured by it that I really wanted to speak to him. I'm a bit of a philosophy geek myself, so this episode really allowed me to indulge myself. But I do think that there is a lot we can learn from different ways of looking at death, which might instill a sense of calm in us whilst we live. Simon joined me from his place in New York, where he's lived for the last 20 years, and we chatted about his journey into philosophy as someone who came from a working class family and achieved little success in school initially. We deep dived into his personal favourite philosophies on death, and how we can find meaning. And I asked Simon where he finds comfort when it comes to his own mortality as someone who ponders the big questions of life. So keep listening for all that and more on this episode of the Life and Death podcast. So thanks for joining me, Simon. It really is a pleasure to see you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I'm very happy to be here.
Simon, I wonder if we could start with just a little bit of background, just share maybe some biographical detail. I think where I'm curious is the journey from kind of infant to philosopher. But a little bit about you, where you're from, background, etc., would be really interesting.
All right. So I grew up in Hertfordshire, 30 miles north of London, but all of my family are from Liverpool, and Liverpool was always home, and we went back there as often as we could. My mother and father came down south in the 1950s for work, basically, because the economy in Liverpool was still sort of reeling from the effects of the Second World War. And then I went to school. I failed dramatically at school, failed all of my O-levels apart from one, which was a geography O-level. I got a C grade. And then I had a very bad accident when I was 18. I had I was working in a pharmaceutical factory, and my left hand was effectively severed and then stitched back on. And it's a long story, which I won't bore you with. But that kind of had the effect of, firstly, I lost a lot of memory, as people often do with trauma. And so I'd lost years of my childhood, and it seemed to kind of reset me as a person. So from that time, I was 18, 19, going through a lot of stuff. But at that point, I began to read really voraciously, and then found my way back to college, a further education college in Stevenage. Yeah, back then back then in Britain, you could get a second chance at education, and I did that. And then someone said you should apply to university, and I hadn't crossed my mind. None of my friends went to university, and then things really began to, you know, accelerate. And I did my education, then got a job as an academic firstly in Cardiff, and then back at the University of Essex, where I did my PhD. And then, I sort of, you know, rumbled on writing and then wound up here in 2004, 20 years ago in New York. And the rest is history, I guess.
I suppose in my rather romantic, I was going to start this podcast by saying there's basically two jobs that I always wanted growing up. One was to be work in a think tank.
Oh, yeah.
And one was to be a philosopher, because I thought that both of them would just pay me just simply to think, to produce thought. I was like, oh, I could do that. I suppose what I was wondering is how much of it was a dissatisfaction and some hope or belief or desire for philosophy to provide some answers, I suppose. Do you know what I mean? Rather than just a pure academic yeah. subject, what was your skin in the game, as it were? What was your suffering or your dissatisfaction or your push to philosophy, if any?
Okay, well, I think I've got an answer to that, which is anxiety. Mm. When I went to university in my first year, I had what people would call a nervous breakdown. And it was awful. And I had this overwhelming sense of dread. And I hadn't really experienced it before. And I didn't know what it meant. And I went to a doctor. I got some drugs, which, I mean, back in, this is, you know, the early 80s. I mean, God knows what they were. But they made me feel as if I was sort of wrapped in tissue paper with the same feeling inside. So I stopped doing those. I began to kind of impose a kind of a discipline on myself, which I still have to this day. I kind of leading a fairly orderly life and also exercising every day, which I still do. And then I found that philosophy had something to say about anxiety. The anxiety, the text that really hit me was a text by Martin Heidegger, where he has this one line, anxiety reveals the nothing. Anxiety reveals the nothing. And I, without knowing what he meant, I knew what he meant. And one reason for going into philosophy as a, you know, and getting paid to think, which is great, although it's less great than it used to be, the idea that I could help or speak to people that were like me, and perhaps philosophy would help them too, because it gave me a vocabulary for thinking about what I was feeling, and enabling me to, giving me concepts for that would enable me to go on. I mean, I was fairly clear around 25. I remember having the thought, walking down the street in Colchester, that I was never going to be happy. I remember that very clearly, having that thought, well, I'm not going to be happy because that's just not the way I seem to be built. But I can do something with this anxiety. I can use it as a kind of a clarifying impetus, and then perhaps I'll find people who are similar to me in that respect. Mm. So there was a very clear kind of, even like therapeutic side to philosophy for me very early on, and that remains the case. I mean, that's still what I'm doing with students when I'm in my teaching.
I wonder if we could just move on to the book that, in a way, has prompted this podcast from my point of view, which is your book of dead philosophers.
Dead philosophers. Most of them are dead.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, you know, and like you say, we're all heading there, philosophers or otherwise. So the concept of the book is a sort of, first thing to say is it's funny. And that was the thing that drew me. It made me snort. So it's not like that belly laugh. It just catches you. Makes me go, that kind of noise. It comes out when I was reading it. And you sort of take, I can't remember how many you do. It's over 100, what, 150, 100 more, 190
philosophers. Oh, it's more than that. It's, let me check. I have, but my only copy of the book is here, 190 or so.
190
or so, yeah.
Sort of different philosophers, and you say, and some of these are only kind of a couple of paragraphs, some of them a couple of pages, and you introduce a kind of core philosophy that they will be known for, and then you say, if it's known, you talk about how they died. And this is because of a quote from Cicero that then Montaigne goes on to sort of put central within his philosophy, the French writer, philosopher Montaigne. And what's the quote? To philosophize is to
learn how to die.
How to die, yeah.
Yeah.
So for someone who works in palliative care, yeah, and has a kind of interest beyond just my work in the subject of death and dying, when I first read that, I read it as Montaigne. I didn't know that Cicero had written it first. I thought it was Montaigne's. It captured me, like a bit like your Heidegger's quote of anxiety and emptiness mm-hmm. or nothingness. That to learn to philosophize, to learn how to die, completely captured me. But I suppose that the book is about the relationship of philosophy, and in a way, what consolation it gives to our mortality. Is that a fair?
Yes, yeah, it is. It is, yeah. The phrase to philosophize, to learn how to die, is, you know, he's quoting Cicero, but that really goes back to Plato and the beginnings of philosophy. That philosophy is, you can say, an art of dying. The philosopher is the person who comes to terms with their mortality and absorbs their mortality within them. And the when that winds up in Montaigne, the argument really is that what keeps human beings captive, human beings are captive to the fear of death. Or let me put it more extremely, it's because this is the way Montaigne puts it. You know, this is in a time when these words had a perhaps even stronger sense. We are slaves to the fear of death. We're slaves to the fear of death. And therefore, freedom has to be freedom from that fear. And that freedom from the fear of death is not to be had by running away from death, but by confronting it. This quote is great. He says, he who has learned how to die has unlearned how to be a slave. He who has learned how to die has unlearned how to be a slave. So learning the art of dying, which philosophy can teach, frees you from the servitude that you were in before and opens you up for, you know, the reality of your life and to live that life in the best, fullest, and most vivacious way. So the purpose of the book is to kind of present that thought in, you know, 190 different funny ways. And if they're funny, then so much the better, because if you can get people laughing, then you can, or snorting, then you can open them up and do some work with that.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a favourite story within there? Because there's lots of them, and there's lots of unusual deaths.
Oh gosh!
Without putting you on the spot, is there any that kind of?
Well, I mean, there's some astonishing ones. I mean, one of the first ones I tell is Pythagoras, who might or might not have existed. It's the jury is still out on that, but he allowed himself to be killed rather than cross a field of beans, because the Pythagoreans had a particular enmity towards beans, because for various reasons, but it's thought because they resembled the male testes and they had to be avoided at all costs, because the Pythagoreans were also very anti-sex. They were a chaste group, a lot of women Pythagoreans as well. So in order to remain Pythagorean, he allows himself to be killed. And then you've got things like, I've got a list here, you know, Lucretius, author of the De Rerum Natura, the fantastic book on nature, is alleged to have killed himself after being driven mad by taking a love potion. Hypatia, the first woman who's mentioned in the books, actually the second woman first mentioned in the book, but Hypatia was head of the Academy of Alexandria, which was the center of world learning at the time, and she was killed by a mob of angry Christians, kind of populist Trumpers, you know, who were, you know, getting a grip in Alexandria, and she was taken out from her carriage and she was killed, and her skin was peeled off with oyster shells, so one source says. And so it goes on. And, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, one great one, I think, is a more recent one and a more local one would be, and one that people can find for themselves if they have the chance, is Jeremy Bentham. I mean, Jeremy Bentham had himself stuffed, and he sits on public view in a glass box in University College London in order to maximize the utility of his person, because he was the father of utilitarianism. And also in college meetings at the University College London, I think it's still the case, it certainly was the case, Bentham is listed as present, but not voting. So the you know, the mixture of humour and, you know, mortality, I think is, you know, it helps. It's a tonic, and so the purpose of the book is to make philosophy more accessible.
Sure. So before I move on from that, can I just say, could you condense the idea that to philosophize is to learn how to die?
Mm-hmm.
The act that one would be doing, i.e. to philosophize, is simply to be able to look at death more directly. I mean, Montaigne says all the time, doesn't he? You know, as you chew and you drink and you just think of it all the time. So it isn't so much that there is a kind of thing you do with your mind, with your thinking. It's just attend to this reality. Be mindful of this reality. Is the philosophizing process? Is that too reductive?
Yeah, it's the framing. So the immortality is what frames our existence. That is the frame, and we have to not be morbid about it, but to be aware of that and not to fear it. To have if possible, a kind of calm, a kind of peace about that. Epicurus has this thing which he calls the four-part cure, the tetrapharmakos, and it is don't fear death, don't worry about God, what is good is easy to get, and what is terrible is easy to endure. The thing about God is that, you know, God is... might or might not be out there, but it's of no real concern to us. We can't know that. But what we can do is not fear death. And so for the Epicureans, that was the cornerstone of a philosophical wisdom. Once you've got that ability to approach the frame of your life calmly, peacefully, then you can then begin to look at the rest. So it's a kind of background coping that allows you then to think more soberly about, you know, what are you going to do? And so this idea of my mortality is really important, because it means that it alters my relationship to those people that are going to come after me, right? And it's about enabling them to do the thinking and living that they want to do. And you're going to, you know, we're all going to disappear. And then, you know, what does that mean? Well, I'm very keen on this old Greek idea of what they call glory. And glory, really, it really consisted in the stories that are told about you after your death. And that was one way of thinking about what the Greeks thought about immortality, was glory in the sense in which the stories that are told about you. And that's an afterlife. And that's perhaps enough of an afterlife for all of us, I think.
Where do you get your comfort from philosophy about your own mortality?
I get my comfort. I mean, it's not necessarily from... How would I put that? I find a comfort in teaching... You know, what a very abstruse, complicated text to young people, in a way that can make them theirs, and they can use them and do something with them. I find a comfort in that. But in a sense, the comfort I find is in other spheres of life. I mean, you know, to be in things like music, which is very important to me, and the listening to music with someone that you love. So, you know, me and my wife listen to music, and she's got very good musical taste, and we sit there with a drink and listen to tracks, and it's glorious. There's a tremendous consolation in that, and the idea that won't happen at a certain point is it's incredibly painful. But then that can also lead you to really enjoy the fact of being there with with the person that you love and really being there with them and not wishing you were somewhere else. And I think the terrible thing about life is that, you know, people waste decades with forms of striving and ambition and perhaps duplicity and dishonesty, and you know, and it leads you away from what's really important, what really endures, what really lasts, which is love. And the last thing I'd say is that, you know, as we're speaking, my football team, Liverpool Football Club, are playing against Sparta Prague, and I've got one eye on my other laptop as I'm speaking to you, but I'm giving my full attention. and I remember taking a photograph of my grandmother, or my, as we call it, my nan's grave about 10 years ago, say 10, 15 years ago. And on that grave, there's a Liverpool club crest. And then my father was, at Anfield all the time as a young man. And he brought me up with this to support the team and that wasn't just about football. It was about a series of values connected with that. And then I had a son who's now 32. He lives in London and he supports Liverpool with the same intensity that I support Liverpool. So just in that terms of one family, and we're not a particularly good example of a family, but there's 100 years of support for that team, whatever that means. And that's something. And that the idea that will go on, and that will go on without you, is... It's fine. And what would the alternative be? The alternative would be, you know, infinite longevity, which would be horrible. There's this wonderful passage in Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift with these characters that he calls the Struldbrugs. And the Struldbrugs are mortal humans who are immortal. They're human beings who live forever. And they're marked with a black spot in the middle of their forehead. That's how you know there's a Struldbrug. And he describes these Struldbrugs as, lying in the side of the road, kind of propped up. They've lost all interest in life. They no longer understand what's being said. They're just deeply, deeply bored by existence, and they'd love it to end. So our mortality is what makes the whole thing possible. And keeping that end in mind, I think, can be freeing and enabling, and also make people more empathetic and compassionate and understanding, which is the most important thing, it seems to me, that whenever we look at human beings and what human beings do, to look at them with empathy and understanding and not judgment and critique. I think philosophy has been far too preoccupied with the business of critique and tearing things down. I'm much more inclined to those traditions which are based on empathy, understanding, describing states of affairs and trying to do something with that rather than rip everything to shreds.
Simon, that is a brilliant credo to live by. I'd sign up. I'm in. Simon, you've been extraordinarily generous, as wise as I would maybe expect, if not more so, but just very, very open and honest. And I really appreciated this conversation with you today. Really, really.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a pleasure.
So there we go, fully indulged, a wander around philosophical thought from the Western canon, touching a little bit on other philosophies. I think one of the things that I was really touched by talking to Simon, I think I asked him about the consolations of philosophy, how he finds consolation in it. And after a few moments reflection, he mentioned how much he enjoyed listening to music, particularly listening to his music with his wife, and also the role that football plays in finding sort of meaning or at least pleasure in life. And I suppose after a rather abstract discussion about philosophy, it was really lovely to have it anchored down in these very concrete, everyday, easy to relate to activities, which we all have versions of, really. So it was great to do that journey with Simon, to go all the way up to the top, as it were, and then come back down to Liverpool and Bowie, really. Thanks, Simon. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospice.org.uk, where you can find lots of resources. This episode was produced by Olivia Swift, and it's a Reform Radio production. You've been listening to the Life and Death podcast by Ashgate Hospice. I've been your host, Stephen. Thank you, and we'll see you again next time.